This is Johnny Bluestar. Welcome to Threshold, a global media event. Is the universe just a random dance of atoms? Or is it a manifestation of a supremely intelligent architect? Can its purpose, or our purpose here on Earth, be adequately assessed? Can we commune with it, know its intentions, cooperate with its direction? Here, we define Threshold as a gateway state of awareness, allowing mankind to cross into a place of real cognition. Threshold allows us to approach questions of higher reality through the door of experience rather than mere belief. Welcome to Threshold, where we tear away the veil from commercial media, bringing our audience and participants into another realm of reality and enhanced communication.
Welcome back to Threshold. This is Johnny Bluestar. In about a half an hour, we will be meeting with Robert Hastings, UFO author and researcher. His specialty is the surveillance of missile sites and other nuclear weapon facilities by UFOs. To many of our listeners, they will be surprised to find out that this is an activity which has gone on regularly for decades. In fact, since just a few years after the dropping of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Robert's book is called UFO and Nukes and is subtitled Extraordinary Encounters at Nuclear Weapon Sites. You can purchase this book at his website, ufohastings.com. That's ufohastings.com. I mention this at the outset because I consider this work rather extraordinary, and I will make reference to it during this interview. Before we begin the interview, I thought to set the mood, we might take a little bit of retrospective look, not really fondly nostalgic though, the beginnings of the atomic age. I would say that the beginning of this era was the day the United States dropped the bomb on Japan. It was August 6th, 1945 in Japan, but August 5th here. That precise date was the day I was born in Tinkerfield Air Force Base. My father was promoted to captain that day, having been one of the first 9 men recruited during his second year at Harvard Law School by what was then called the Army Air Corps, the entity that later on became the United States Air Force. I was given a little tiny captain's pin and to celebrate his promotion. Lest the record be mistaken, my father was in the judge advocate's office and that was his role during much of his service. My parents determined prenatally that I would be a writer and even gave me a middle name to use as a surname for my predestined career. I never used it, but chose another. Nonetheless, I did become a writer. But I never forgot when I was born, and the significance of that event has always been engraved in my mind. What has that got to do with UFOs, also of an obsession of mine since a child? It turns out that connection between UFOs and those atomic explosions turns out to be a great deal. We're going to learn a lot about it later. I spoke about first taking a retrospective look. Here is President Truman's speech following a few days after the bombing of Hiroshima.
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima and destroyed its usefulness to the enemy. That bomb has more power than 20,000 tons of TNT. The Japanese began the war from the air at Pearl Harbor. They have been repaid many fold, and the end is not yet. With this bomb, we have now added a new and revolutionary increase in destruction to supplement the growing power of our armed forces. In their present form, these bombs are now in production, and even more powerful forms are in development. It is an atomic bomb. It is a harnessing of the basic power of the universe. The force from which the sun draws its power has been loosed against those who brought war to the Far East. We are now prepared to destroy more rapidly and completely every productive enterprise the Japanese have in any city. We shall destroy their docks, their factories, and their communications. Let there be no mistake, we shall completely destroy Japan's power to make war. It was to spare the Japanese people from utter destruction that the ultimatum of July the 26th was issued at Potsdam. Their leaders promptly rejected that ultimatum. If they do not now accept our terms, they may expect a rain of ruin from the air, the like of which has never been seen on this earth. Behind this air attack will follow sea and land forces in such numbers and power as they have not yet seen, and with the fighting skill of which they are already well aware. We have spent more than $2 billion on the greatest scientific gamble in history, and we have won. But the greatest marvel is not the size of the enterprise, its secrecy, or its cost, but the achievement of scientific brains in making it work. And hardly less marvelous has been the capacity of industry to design the machines and methods to do things never done before. Both science and industry work together under the direction of the United States Army, which achieved a unique success in an amazingly short time. It is doubtful if such another combination could be got together in the world. What has been done is the greatest achievement of organized science in history.
Well, Truman's frank demeanor is indicative of the mood of many people at the time, celebrative of a great scientific achievement, as he sternly admonishes the people of Japan to the great problems that might lie ahead for a nation foolish enough not to surrender. Of course, they didn't have much time to think, because 3 days after Hiroshima came Nagasaki. A study called Children of the Atomic Bomb, a UCLA physician's eyewitness report and call to save the world's children, says, "The real mortality of the atomic bomb that was dropped on Japan will never be known. Destruction, overwhelming chaos made orderly counting impossible. It is not unlikely that the estimates of killed and wounded in Hiroshima, 150,000, and Nagasaki, 75,000, that's both killed and wounded, are over-conservative. Many died later from radiation poisoning and their injuries." According to an article called "Hiroshima Blast Haunts Korean Survivors" in Bloomberg Business by Sam Kim, written on August 4th of this year, quote, "Koreans are the largest group of non-Japanese victims. A survivors association estimates that about 30,000 of the 70,000 Koreans in Hiroshima and Nagasaki at the time lived through the bombs. A monument to Korean victims at the Peace Memorial Park in Hiroshima states that about 10% of those 200,000 people lost to the bomb were ethnically Korean. These Koreans were mostly day laborers, a euphemism for slave laborers conscripted by the Japanese to help them during their war efforts. Although there was a military presence in both cities, the majority of civilians were the ones who were killed or injured. Weapons of mass destruction have no respect for innocent children, pregnant women or stay-at-home mothers, elderly people, working-class people with no taste for war. The sick and disabled or foreign nationals, they are all the same to an atomic bomb or a weapon of mass destruction. When you consider war of this type, you have to look at your victims as persons whose death may be a grim necessity in some way, but necessary for political, societal, military, or personal reasons. I would imagine that a race of beings from another star system or another dimension that would happen to be spiritually or morally advanced might look at things differently. Anyway, it turned out that putting various specific speculations aside about their nature, aliens may have been surveying the first atomic bomb squadron on July 7th, 1947, when their vehicle crashed. Before the weather balloon claim as the fundamental cause of the event, there was an official press release and radio report that explained things different. I'm talking, of course, about Roswell. Here it is, two years later, after we dropped the bombs.
Headline edition, July 8, 1947. The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army. Army officers say the missile, found sometime last week, has been inspected at Roswell, New Mexico, and sent to Wright Field, Ohio, for further inspection. Late this afternoon, a bulletin from New Mexico suggested that the widely publicized mystery of the flying saucers may soon be solved. Army Air Force officers reported that one of the strange disks had been found and inspected sometime last week. Our correspondents in Los Angeles and Chicago have been in contact with Army officials endeavoring to obtain all possible late information. Joe Wilson reports to us now from Chicago.
The Army may be getting to the bottom of all this talk about the so-called flying saucer. As a matter of fact, the 509th Atomic Bomb Group headquarters at Roswell, New Mexico, reports that it has received one of the disks, which landed on a ranch outside Roswell. The disk landed at a ranch at Corona, New Mexico, and the rancher turned it over to the Air Force. Rancher W.W. Brazell was the man who discovered the saucer. Colonel William Blanchard of the Roswell Air Base refuses to give details of what the flying disk looks like. In Fort Worth, Texas, where the object was first sent, Brigadier General Roger Ramey says that it is being shipped by air to the AAF Research Center at Wright Field, Ohio. A few moments ago, I talked to officials at Wright Field, and they declared that they expect the so-called flying saucer to be delivered there, but that it hasn't arrived as yet. In the meantime, General Ramey describes the object as being of flimsy construction, almost like a box type. He says that it was so battered that he was unable to determine whether it had a disc form, and he does not indicate its size. Ramey says that so far as can be determined, no one saw the object in the air, and he describes it as being made of some sort of tinfoil. Other Army officials say that further information indicates that the object had a diameter of about 20 to 25 feet, and that nothing in the apparent construction indicated any capacity for speed, and that there was no evidence of a power plant. The disc also appeared too flimsy to carry a man. Now, back to Taylor Grant in New York.
There was important activity within the UN Security Council today.
This program is not essentially about Roswell today, but Roswell may be at least the first publicly known aspect of UFO surveillance of our atomic and nuclear weapon sites and facilities covered in the research of our guest, Robert Hastings. It's fascinating that after the significant and almost unthinkable devastation in Japan, the United States was not content with a small thing like an atomic bomb. It soon embarked on another great scientific adventure, coming in on an early fruition in 1952. It was called the hydrogen bomb.
You have a grandstand seat here to one of the most momentous events in the history of science. In less than a minute, you will see the most powerful explosion ever witnessed by human eyes. The blast will come out of the horizon just about there. And this is the significance of the moment. This is the first full-scale test of a hydrogen device. If the reaction goes, we're in the thermonuclear era. For the sake of all of us, and for the sake of our country, I know that you join me in wishing this expedition well.
It is now 30 seconds to zero time. Put on goggles or turn away. Do not remove goggles or face burst until 10 seconds after the first light.
Let's just pause for a station break, and we will take this with a more lighthearted song by UK songwriter Stephanie Slevin, a song in heavy rotation in radio stations throughout the world.
Know that you love me the most. I know by the way you stare at me, that deep down inside you care for me. You may drink champagne to my cup of tea, but nobody freaking cares. And you say I ain't the one for you, that I'm way down there beneath the view. But look at what your poor shake's done to you, and nobody freaking cares. She took your money and laughed at you, and then slept with all your mates and they were laughing too. So let's kick her to the curb, yeah, me and you, for nobody freaking cares. And I know you said bad things of me, but deep down inside you care for me. For they say love and hate are so very close, so I know that you love me the most. Drink in your one night stand, so please don't judge me by your own bad hand. Yeah, stand up straight, just be the man, for nobody freaking cares. And come down off your mighty horse and take a chance on me, and we'll run the course, and we'll show the bitch we don't do divorce, for nobody freaking cares. And I know you said bad things of me, but deep down inside you care for me. For they say love and hate are so very close, so I know that you love me the most. Yes, I know that you love me the most.
Boots in Manhattan is a coming-of-age novel by Ray Boylan and Johnny Bluestar. It is about a young Tom Boots Raymond who grows up in New York in the 1940s, who is a member of a street gang.
My friends and I were about to start our own game of stickball when Rabbit Lacey, the head of the Rattlers, came up to us and tried to move in on our game. We were called dwarves, the youngest members of the stupid gang.
Hey, Kevin, I need you to get some gloves and some stuff I left at my place.
No, this is our game.
Hey, are you my good little dwarf or what?
You've been calling me a dwarf since I was six. We're not your personal slaves, pal.
Hey, what is this? A dwarf rebellion? All right, big guy. We ditched the dwarf thing. We make you guys regular rattlers.
No, it's too late.
He looked at Jay and me. We looked away. Rabbit was now angry, and he pushed Kevin hard with the palms of his hand. Kevin tried to ram him in the stomach, but he stepped aside, throwing Kevin into the curb where he fell to the ground, bleeding profusely at the knee. Still, he managed to get up.
My street.
Kevin shouted at Rabbit, pointing at him with an angry index finger.
Find out more by Googling Boots in Manhattan, a 1940s coming-of-age novel, part one of the novel series The Foot Soldier by Ray Boylan and Johnny Bluestar. Google with the words Boots in Manhattan, Ray Johnny Kindle. That's Boots in Manhattan, Ray Johnny Kindle.
Nowadays, if you are a serious business person, just getting assistance from someone with a license and a bit of experience may not be sufficient. In fact, your realtor actually needs to be knowledgeable enough to be one of your top advisors. Whether you are facilitating a giant merger or selling your company, there's a lot at stake besides your finances. There is the future value of your current investment, financial freedom, integrity, and overall reputation. If you need this kind of assistance, Sandra LaFlamme is a real estate expert with the experience, reputation, and knowledge qualified to assist you in all your key transactions. Sandra LaFlamme, real estate services with integrity and conscience. Contact her today at 888-366-8070. That's Sandra LaFlamme at 888-366-8070.
Before the break, we played a clip of the actual launching, the actual explosion of the first H-bomb. Now, that fortunately was not over a city, but it was a test. But it was a very well-publicized test eventually. But if many politicians, scientists, and citizens were impressed, famed newscaster and commentator Edward R. Murrow and his associate Bill Downs still had their reservations, very articulately delivered.
Good evening. The Atomic Energy Commission has just announced the completion of successful experiments in what it calls contributing to the development of thermonuclear weapons. This probably means one of the most important developments of our time, the hydrogen bomb. For the latest details, We take you to Washington and Bill Downs.
Well, Ed, this seems to me to be more a day for a searching of the human soul, perhaps, than for any kind of scientific celebration. Because from the announcement by the Atomic Energy Commission, it is pretty evident that we have discovered the secret of the hydrogen bomb. That's what really a thermonuclear explosion, as they call it, is. And from best evidence, unofficial, it seems clear that the first H-bomb ever exploded in the world was exploded on November the 1st, 7:15 a.m., in a Weacock time. We've now designed mankind's most devastating weapon, a weapon that will make Hiroshima, Nagasaki, the bikini tests, and the rest of them look puny by comparison. The experts tell us that the difference between an atomic bomb and a hydrogen bomb is the difference between a 12-gauge shotgun and a 16-inch cannon. The hydrogen bomb is capable of devastating not 15 or so miles, as at Hiroshima, but hundreds of miles, perhaps. Thus, a single blast could wipe out everything between New York and Trenton, New Jersey, everything between Los Angeles and San Diego. A single blast of a hydrogen bomb could cover a good part of the English Channel. A single blast of a hydrogen bomb could wipe out Moscow and devastate everything between there and Tula and Tulinan. One blast could wipe out everything between Beiping and Tientsin and Red China. One blast could cover an area between Pyongyang and the Yalu in North Korea. We have not made this bomb as yet. We have just discovered how to make it. Perhaps the Atomic Energy Commission would have been wise if they had made the announcement before today's church services. Now back to Ed Murrow in New York.
It would perhaps be unwise to assume that because we have made the hydrogen bomb, the Russians are unable to make it. If this is indeed the beginning of the hydrogen age, it might be useful to quote from something that Albert Einstein said. I'm going to read a bit of this because if this is the beginning of the hydrogen age, I should like to get it all quite accurate. He said, the hydrogen bomb appears on the public horizon as a probably attainable goal. Its accelerated development has been solemnly proclaimed by the president. If successful, radioactive poisoning of the atmosphere and hence annihilation of any life on Earth has been brought within the range of technical possibility. That was a statement made, I think, in 1950.
Well, we've been discussing the early years of what Murrow calls the hydrogen age. Here's another news clip expressing the determination of the United States and its allies from the spread of communist aggression. This news clip is really very interesting, not only from what it says, but just because of its tone.
On the European front, General Eisenhower welded his North Atlantic Pact army together with troops of 11 nations in a force which he hoped to raise to 62 divisions by 1954. European nations are expected to strain their economies to the limit to meet the defense requirements set up in his blueprint. The new laws were the direct outgrowth of a staggering new defense budget of $58 billion. In a world of unrest, Americans shouldered an additional burden in the struggle between East and West, where the race for atomic weapons assumed new proportions and guided missiles took on new importance. The Matador, which someday may carry an atomic charge, was one of America's answers in the armament race, a contest that is the insurance of the free world against slavery.
Well, that gives you an idea of what's going on with us back there in the 1950s. But, you know, still it's still a tricky time in world history, you know. Before we meet our guest, Robert Hastings, which we will shortly, let us flash forward for a few moments and take a look at what he says about our current dilemma, perhaps even more poignant since the book was published in 2008. After speaking a bit about the progress and setbacks in nuclear arms talks between Russia and the United States, Hastings writes in his book, UFOs and Nukes. In any case, the bottom line is this. America and Russia are armed to the teeth, and there's no guarantee that these weapons will not be used at some point. The Strategic Offensive Reductions Treaty, also called SORT, requires that the two countries reduce the number of operationally deployed warheads on each side to between 1,700 and 2,200 by the year 2012. Although this is far lower than the number of deployed nukes during the height of the Cold War, the reduced arsenals mandated by SORT nonetheless remain a real and ongoing threat to mankind. Further, due to the introduction of ballistic missiles, which lie undetected off U.S. and Russian coastlines, the total time between missile launch and massive destruction has been reduced to less than 10 minutes. Although the SORT Treaty was replaced by the START 1 Treaty and there have been subsequent negotiations, the conclusions that Hastings drew remain basically the same. According to Plowshares Fund, a foundation that monitors the stockpile of nuclear weapons, there are 15,695 nuclear weapons in the world, with the U.S. with 7,100 weapons and with Russia with somewhat the same, leading the pack. This is not to completely diminish the threat of nuclear weapons used by India, China, Pakistan, potentially used, North Korea, France, etc. Still, the Russian-American overload of weapons of this type is problematic. Hastings cites a quote from the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, then Executive Director Kenneth Benedict, which is the site of which has long monitored our approach to nuclear apocalypse. Benedict says, saying that he's not so much concerned about the other countries. He says, I think the elephant in the room is still the fact that Russia and the U.S. have not stood down from their Cold War launch readiness. Number of weapons we have is the equivalent of 80,000 Hiroshima bombs. The bomb dropped on Hiroshima killed 100,000 people. We've got 80,000 of those. So we could theoretically kill 8 billion people. There are only 6 billion left on this planet. Well, let's take a break from this, and prior to our beginning the interview, let's play a song written by Edgar Arons and myself and sung by Patricia Welch. It's called Desperate Games.
Century, El Tesoro de Cielo, a Spanish treasure ship sends a scouting expedition to a strange island. Golden statues surrounding them prove the enormity of their find. Suddenly, hordes of ghoulish creatures with scaly green flesh and skeletal wings descend upon them from the sky.
What do you think of this, Rufio?
These creatures are fragile, Captain. We can take them with our swords.
They seem supernatural. Who knows what powers they possess?
Fallen angels, weakened by their treason.
My God! Are you saying they're Nephilim, the devil's host?
I'm saying whatever they are, we can take them. Do any of you cowards dare join me?
up against sharp knife-like nails and hideous fangs, the men's swords rip into slimy green flesh. Though black blood pours copiously from their half-naked bodies, the creatures miraculously persist. Can the crew survive this bloody, cursed battle?
Find out more by Googling The Thrice Born, a new sci-fi supernatural novel by Carlos Lopez Avery and Johnny Bluestar. Google with the words Carlos Johnny Kendall, The Thrice Born. That's Carlos Johnny Kendall, The Thrice Born.
New Galaxy Enterprises is a media company specializing in wide-ranging content like novels, nonfiction books, screenplays, commercial advertising, web content, etc. One of our most esteemed providers is illustrator Robert W. Zalo. I work on all my most important projects like book covers, logos, web design elements with Robert. As an illustrator, he worked on the Ignatz-nominated comic book, The Expert's Guide to Killing Things That Go Bump in the Night. His skills encompass advertising, magazine illustrations, gaming, comic books, TV production, and scenic painting. His clients include Comcast, Adelphia, Haven Talent, Forceworks, High Octane Theater, Star Creative Advertising. If you wish to contact Robert, go to johnnybluestar.com and let me know. That's johnnybluestar.com. For artist, illustrator Robert Zalo, an essential component of all the work we do. Maybe he can help you too.
Good morning, Robert. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Terrific. Really pleased that you've come here. I don't know if you heard, I quoted from your book about the SORT, the Strategic Offense Reduction Treaty, which is not really going on anymore. But what I wanted to point out and by reading it is that we are now in a time of really dangerous escalating tensions between the United States and its NATO allies and the Russian Federation. We are at a point, we're not in a Cold War exactly, but we are in something that's very, very strange. First in Ukraine, now in Syria, now Russia is attacking ISIS, sort of to our advantage, except that he's protecting Assad, and of course, the United States and its allies are against Assad, and it's becoming a rather strange situation, don't you think?
This world seems to have always been on that course, and unfortunately, even though they're not in the headlines these days like they were in the Cold War, nuclear weapons are still a major part of the equation. My book has a chapter called Lucky So Far, in which I itemize some cases in the past where either we or the Russians were within literally minutes, 3 minutes, 5 minutes of launching World War III because we had misinterpreted the other guy's signals. And these cases have now been declassified. They're available on the internet. You can read about them where, again, either the Soviet leaders or our own leaders feared that the other side had begun World War III or was about to. So the conditions that led to those misinterpretations still exist. Humans are fallible creatures. As you mentioned, we do have an increased degree of tension, especially in the last couple of years between us and Russia, largely, in my opinion, due to the actions of Putin. I mean, he seems to be very aggressive, almost in the old style of the Soviet leaders. Not that we were entirely blameless as a nation in terms of our policies and actions during the Cold War, but it seems to me that he's really pushing the envelope these days. And if during the Cold War we were capable of mistakenly launching World War III, those conditions, that set of circumstances still exist today, which is quite worrisome to say the least.
It seems to me that you could honestly say that the mad scenario, mutually assured destruction, has not really changed because we still have enough firepower to destroy the entire world and bring in a nuclear winter.
That's it. And, you know, the question has always been, do we really need to have overkill to the degree that we did, both us and the Soviets? I mean, we had, you know, 1,000 times more weapons in terms of megatonnage than we would ever need to destroy the other nation. Of course, nuclear warfare being what it is, you have drifting radiation across the globe carried by the jet stream, and so other nations, even not involved in the conflict, would suffer the consequences, even though they weren't destroyed because of the weapons themselves. Over time, their lands and water, the oceans would be polluted with ungodly amounts of radiation, which has a long-term consequences for the health of humans and non-human species, of course. So again, because we seemingly have a less tense period in our history than we did during the Cold War, although that's debatable, as we've been saying, people don't realize that waiting in the wings at a moment's notice, we still have all of this firepower, as do the Russians, and it only takes one misunderstanding or one crazy politician to make that become, if not the end of mankind, certainly something that would set our species back and the planetary environment to an unbelievable degree.
What's really interesting about your work is that what you've recorded and really studied and tried to present to the public is a very strong warning, a very unusual and interesting warning, that although you are out there and you've had, your press conference and your book is out and you've had interviews and articles, your work has gone, along with many other people in this field of UFO research, largely unnoticed. Certainly, it's particularly strange, since it is so, this kind of appearances of UFOs and military missile sites has been very prolific, hasn't it? Extremely prolific.
I've tried my best now since 1981 to bring this situation to the public's attention. I don't know what you said in the first half hour of the program, but I have attempted since the early 80s to make people aware, including journalists, who of course have the ability to inform large numbers of people both here and abroad about the reality of the UFO nukes connection. I have witnesses even in World War II, even before the war ended, former military people discussing UFO incursions at atomic weapons sites. So from the birth of the nuclear age, whoever are flying these craft took an immediate interest in what we humans were doing. And while not directly interfering in any comprehensive degree, they certainly have demonstrated their displeasure by, in my view, that's how I interpret it, by tampering with these weapons both here and in the Soviet Union. Those listeners who've not seen my press conference or the YouTube clips from it, what I had were seven retired Air Force officers, persons I had interviewed over the years, coming forward and saying not only did UFOs monitor American nuclear weapons during the Cold War, but on a number of occasions they actually tampered with the weapons. Nuclear missile launch officers described situations where security personnel at ground level described a saucer-shaped object suddenly flying in and hovering on a dime, stopping on a dime and hovering directly over a launch control facility, at which point as many as 10 ICBMs, nuclear missiles, went offline in a mysterious fashion. That has happened again and again and again. And the book that I published in 08 is currently being revised. I am adding additional cases to it, but it's currently available at my website, ufohastings.com, on the book page, UFOs and Nukes. If you're interested in the verbatim testimony from tape-recorded conversations, either video or audio tape, with these military witnesses, I have 600 pages of that testimony. I caution you not to go to Amazon and try to buy the book, because scalpers will charge you up to $200 for it. They're preying on people who don't know that the book is still in print. If you go directly to my website, it's only $23.95. Even though the information that's emerged from the former Soviet Union is minuscule, journalist George Knapp had literally smuggled documents out in 1993 confirming that UFOs had tampered with Soviet missiles. That kind of activity, based on the testimony I'm getting from people who were involved in incidents as recently as 2 years ago, clearly indicates that even though the Cold War is over, whoever are flying these craft are still engaging in these provocative actions, at least in the United States, and I'm almost certain in Russia as well.
Well, I will say that this book, which I've just read, is just, it's very exciting. It's not just, although yes, there's tons of testimonials, it's also extremely well written and very interesting, including the parts at the end which talk about different forms of faster-than-light travel, which I thought also was added a lot to the rounding out of what the book is talking about, the possibilities for mankind actually launching into interstellar space. Let's start at the beginning, though. Could you tell us a little bit more about how you began in this field? I mentioned that I was born in an Air Force base, one that you probably know called Tinker Field, on the day the atomic bomb was actually exploded on August 5th here in the United States, 1945. And I understand, I think you were born in on an Air Force base too, is that correct?
Yeah, I was born actually at Sandia Base, which was, aside from Los Alamos, was the most sensitive nuclear weapons base in the nation. I'm not sure how that relates to what I've chosen to do with my life, but in any case, I was born May 6, 1950 at Sandia Base. It's now where the Sandia National Laboratories are. The weapons were designed up in Los Alamos, New Mexico, and then they were assembled down at Sandia Base in Albuquerque. In any case, my father was career Air Force. He was in for 20 years. He got out in 1967, retired. But his last assignment in 1966-67 was at Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana, which is, even to this day, one of the key nuclear missile bases that this nation has. And in March of 67, there was a situation where rumors began to circulate on base, and in particular in a large building he worked at called the Sage Building, which was basically the military's radar operations center. Rumors began to circulate of mysterious aerial objects being tracked on radar that would fly in and maneuver around the nuclear missile sites. And my father was not directly involved in radar operations, but he worked with people that were. And again, within the Sage Building, these rumors were circulating freely. And he was aware of the fact that these were going on. At the same time, even though I was a junior in high school, I had a job three nights a week at the air traffic control tower on the base as a custodian, as a janitor. I would go in for about 3 hours, three nights a week, and clean up. And over time, I made the acquaintance of a couple of the air traffic controllers. These guys were FAA, not Air Force. And one of them in particular was quite gracious with his time. During his breaks, he would answer lots of questions I had about radar, how it worked, and so on and so forth. But every night that I was in there cleaning up, I would go into what was called RAPCON, the Radar Approach and Control Center, where the FAA controllers and a couple of Air Force controllers sat over, hunched over their radar scopes in this darkened room. And one night in, I've estimated mid to late March of 67, this gentleman who I previously had this relationship with just motioned me over and made some comment to the effect that we're tracking UFOs. It's been so many years, I don't know the term he used, whether it was unidentified, unknowns, UFOs, but he clearly was saying we don't know what these things are. And I asked a couple of questions. I couldn't have stood there more probably than a minute, minute and a half. And he got, suddenly his whole manner got much more businesslike and said, you know, why don't you come back later and clean up? And when I did and went back to empty the trash cans and push the broom, I just briefly, you know, tried to broach the subject. What was that you were talking about before? And he clearly did not want to talk about it. He apparently concluded he had said too much already. The next time I was in there, I caught him in the break room, asked him to elaborate on what he told me, and he clearly did not want to talk about it. So that's all I knew. And that was, again, the spring of 67. I was a teenager. I couldn't do a whole lot with that information other than be excited about it, intrigued about it. But The year after I graduated from college in 1973, I became aware of magazine articles and a couple of books that were published that other authors, other people were talking about UFO incursions at nuclear missile bases. Ray Fowler, Raymond Fowler, who many people may know of in the UFO field. He's a highly respected researcher. At the time, his day job was the Minuteman project supervisor for Sylvania Corporation. And through his contacts at Malmstrom Air Force Base, he was aware of the same things that my dad had heard rumors about. And he said, you know, not only are these objects flying around our missiles, but the missiles seem to go haywire when they do. And long story short, Mr. Fowler got in trouble with his employer for divulging all of that. The Pentagon paid his, the Air Force paid his employer a visit and said, you've got to shut this guy up. Another man named Donald Kehoe, a retired Marine major, published a book in which he said that these kinds of things were going on. This was called Aliens from Space in 1973. And so I became very intrigued by the fact that not only what my FAA source told me was real, what the rumors my dad had heard were involving real events, but that there were other people, respected people, talking about this publicly. And I made a decision at that point in 1973 to begin seeking out former and retired military personnel to see how many people would go on the record about these kinds of things. And one thing led to another over time. You know, at this point, I have over 150 ex-military sources, a handful of civilian sources who were involved in nuclear weapons work, who now, for in one case or another, in one time frame or another, have attested to UFO surveillance and even interference with nuclear weapons.
Do you feel your time spent as a teenager in Malmstrom and the fact that your father was involved with these nuclear weapons and so forth, do you feel a sense of possibly a, sort of a nudge by destiny? Do you feel like you were kind of chosen for what you're doing, or is it feel just something you were interested in?
A number of other people have suggested that. I don't think of it in those terms. It's become the primary focus of my life, certainly. As far as destiny, I don't know what I think about the concept of destiny as opposed to the concept of free will and all these other philosophical questions. I don't view it in those terms. What I have come to realize is that in my mid-60s, I'm 65 now, that this story will not break in my lifetime. The government's holding most of the cards, no matter what. The efforts of people who want disclosure to happen tomorrow, they're spinning their wheels. That won't happen unless whoever flying the craft have decided to up the ante, so to speak, and reveal themselves in a more overt fashion. I'm not going to see a presidential announcement about the reality of UFOs in my lifetime. I'm quite convinced of that. So I've decided that my primary function is just to get as much corroborated, documented testimony as possible for the historical record to establish the fact that this has gone on since the birth of the nuclear age and continues to do so, so that when this does, when this becomes common knowledge, universally accepted at some point in the future, people in general and historians in particular will be able to look back and access a body of credible witness testimony. So that's the only way that I really view what I'm doing. Beyond that, I don't give it a lot of thought.
I understand. Still, you do have a rather important job, because even I have always been interested in this, but I was not aware of the extent of this until I encountered your work. It was really amazing. You know, I read a lot of UFO books, and nothing with this type of emphasis. I think it's really, really important. So,
no one else has stepped up to the plate, certainly. And for whatever reason, I'm not afraid of people laughing at me, which certainly I've had to deal with from the get-go as soon as I went public. I'm not afraid of, you know, my reputation being tarnished because I believe in UFOs and that basic taboo or bugaboo that many people are concerned about. You know, I don't give a shit what people think about in terms of believing or not believing in this. What I'm doing is reporting accurately on the content of declassified documents and reporting accurately on the testimony, recorded testimony, which anyone can access and listen to or watch on video, of 150 military veterans, roughly. And, you know, they can either, you know, hide their heads in the sand or go, my God, this is real, and it seems to be quite important. So, you know, that's very strong armor, so to speak, as I know what I'm talking about. I've got the documented facts. I have to say, ufology, you know, most of what you read about and see on television is crap. I mean, there are people who call themselves researchers who don't even remotely qualify as credible researchers. They don't engage in the fundamentals of documenting the information that they're spewing out publicly. So anyone who wants to get to the bottom of this question, the situation, really needs to take what anyone says, including me, with a grain of salt. If you're interested in what I say or other people say, try to find out whether these people have used credible sources. They vetted those sources. They're not just listening to a third-hand story. Do they have eyewitnesses who are directly involved in incidents and documents, you know, things that are claimed as government documents? There's so many forgeries. There's so much bull out there that you really got to be careful with what you accept as factual, credible information. Again, anyone can go to the archives or write to the agencies themselves and request documents that I present publicly through the Freedom of Information Act and access those documents as well. So everything that I put out in the public domain is credible, is authenticated, and anyone else can independently verify that for themselves if they wish.
What is amazing to me is that, I don't want to be considered too paranoid, but I really do think that it's not just the government that's covering this up, but the news media. I mean, with our obsession with UFOs and science fiction films and TV series, you would think this is the kind of stuff that people would like to hear about, even from I don't mean it seriously, but from an entertainment point of view, it's a very exciting stuff. And the fact that it is almost invisible in the most of the media is amazing. And of course, since a lot of people do not really use the internet properly for their own edification, many, many important things go under the table. Well, we have to take a break now. We'll be back in 5 minutes. We will go to the break with a little piece called Different Worlds by composer Edgar Arens.
Is from West Side Warrior, the memoir of Ray Boylan, a Korean War veteran and crime fighter. He was there fighting in the world's coldest battlefield when the Chinese communists invaded.
Desperate squad members ran past our foxhole yelling, "Get the hell out of here, there's too many of them!" Again, we saw the Chinese soldiers charging in with opium-induced mindlessness, oblivious of our bullets. Again, we heard the bugles and whistles. Climbing out of our foxhole, Bob dropped two hand grenades behind us, and I threw one over my shoulder. Bullets whizzing by our heads, Bob and I became bolts of lightning flashing across the mountainside. Like a hideous film, desperate scenes like this played out on the Tokong Pass for 3 days. Sometimes I played in the scene. Sometimes I could only watch and wonder if it were real, or if I'd be suddenly jolted out of my trance by an RKO usher saying, "Hey, did you kids sneak in here?"
To acquire this book, Google westsidewarrior.boylan.kindle. Boylan is spelled B-O-Y-L-A-N. That's West Side Warrior, Boylan, Kindle.
This is Johnny Bluestar. I've worked as a lyricist with Patricia Welsh for over 5 years, along with Russian composer Edgar Arens.
a friend and colleague. Her ability as a singer is simply amazing. She brings a unique and dramatic flair to every song she sings. Over the next few months, we shall be releasing a number of these songs, part of an album called Hadley's Castle. Meanwhile, Patricia has been busy creating a super enjoyable collection of classic standards in an exciting 46-song, 3-CD collection.
Music for great entertaining introduces Cocktails, Dinner, and Dessert with Patricia Welch. 3 hours of continuous music. 46 of the all-time classic standards, spanning decades of hit songs. Going to a friend's home for dinner? Cocktails, Dinner, and Dessert with Patricia also makes the perfect hostess gift. This 3-CD compilation is the perfect background music that sets just the right mood for any dinner party.
I'm crazy for feeling so lonely. There was a boy, a very strange, enchanted boy.
To purchase this album, just go to patriciawelch.com/CD. That is patriciawelch.com/CD. You won't be disappointed.